This is Scott Allen from odecode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Coon from lazycoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded on May 5th, 2009. Tonight we're talking to Joe Brinkman. Joe, can you introduce yourself, please?
Sure. I am currently the technical fellow at .NET Nuke Corporation. I've been working with .NET Nuke for about the last 6.5 years, as we were recognizing it earlier tonight, and counting that up. So been doing some open source development for probably the last 6 years, pretty hot and heavy, the last 3 years full-time in .NET Nuke.
Well, one thing that has been of interest lately, and you've been part of this conversation, is the web forms versus MVC discussion. And I was talking to you before the call, and you were saying, it's another way of referring to it is that it's an object-oriented versus component development discussion. What do you mean by that?
Well, when you look at what's going on with web forms and how web forms came about, and when you look at the actual framework itself, you see that much of the framework is about ease of use and about reusability, using packaged components to really simplify the web development experience. At least that's, a big thrust of what you see in the web forms world. Versus when you look at what's going on in MVC, whether it's MVC in Java or MVC in Ruby or even MVC and now in ASP.NET, they are much more bare bones, object-oriented, really drilling down from the OO perspective, much more so than from the component perspective. So when you start seeing some of the discussions around MVC versus web forms, in a lot of respects, it comes down to a discussion of component-based development versus OO development. And they're not the same thing. And for some people, they never really think of it in those terms, but when I look at it, that's, one of the first things that pops to mind in terms of what I see.
A lot of people are looking at, the benefits of MVC being that it allows for cleaner separation, gives you more control over your markup, gives you kind of more granular control. One of the things you were talking about in a recent blog post was you were saying that really, you've had some of these levels of control before.
Yeah, I totally agree with that assessment. One of the things that really drives me nuts in the whole MVC versus web forms discussion is some of the arguments used for moving to MVC assume that the only way to do ASP.NET development is to use controls, is to use the web forms. Like, web forms is the only part of ASP.NET that could possibly be of use if you're building a ASP.NET application, right? It totally ignores the fact that you still have web services capability there, that you still have HTTP handlers, you still have HTTP modules, which are not web forms at all, right? So the whole web forms versus MVC debate, I think, is not really accurate in the way that most advanced developers, most senior .NET developers are using .NET web forms or using ASP.NET. I hate the use of the word web forms because it's just one small part of ASP.NET. So when I hear people talk about you've got greater control, I ask them, greater control than what? Greater control than writing my own handler? Not really. I mean, I can do anything I want in my handler. Greater control than using straight HTML in my ASPX page? I just don't see where they're saying, they have greater control over their final rendered output. Sure, I can make the choice in the web forms world to delegate rendering of output to a bunch of controls, but that's a choice that I make. That's not something I have to do, right? I don't have to use controls to do web forms development.
I think that's true, but I do think that there's kind of like the path that a framework guides you towards, and so like where you can and a lot of people have done very, very clean markup or very controlled, you know, frameworks in classic ASP.NET. Is that what we call it now?
Sure.
and I think that it kind of in general guides you towards controls, whereas MVC really guides you towards an object-oriented approach. Would you agree with that?
I would agree to that to some degree. And I say only some degree because MVC doesn't really give you a choice, right? It's one thing to say it guides you in a certain direction, but when you take choice away, to me, that's not guiding. That's, you know, that's making you do something versus giving you the option to do it or sort of suggesting that this is the direction to go in. And I personally prefer to have the choices as to when I want to delegate, when I want more control. And to me, having that option, I feel is more empowering, as a developer. One of the things that some of this comes back to is we keep coming back to this concept of abstractions. And what are the appropriate abstractions? At what level is it good? At what level is it bad? And to me, I think that some of the things that WebForms gets right is that they allow me to abstract things out when I want to. Unfortunately, it just as you say, that also leads to the downside is that for new developers, they tend to use that abstraction and lean on that abstraction very heavily, where sometimes they should be backing off of that. You know, when you look at most new ASP.NET developers, you see them using controls for everything. You know, I look at label control as a classic example. You know, it's like we have a whole control whose sole purpose is to spit out a span. You know, that to me is probably a little bit of an overkill. You know, it's like, you know, so that there are definitely some cases where I think the Microsoft team went a little bit overboard on developing the controls. But there are some of those cases that I think it's wholly appropriate to do what they did in terms of the controls. Personally, I find that some of the capabilities in the grids, and until the advent of things like the jQuery grids and some of the other more advanced client-side grids that have grown up in the last couple of years, until those came along, I think some of the grid controls that were out there by the various vendors really simplified development of some advanced features and functionality, you know, some of the paging stuff, some of the sorting and the ability to drag and reorder columns and do master detail views within a grid. You know, some of those capabilities that we've had on the desktop for a long, long time, the ability to bring those over to the web, I personally think that there's a place for that. And to tell developers that, well, you can have that if you go and roll your own. On each new project you do, you pretty much have to roll your own and do a bunch of copy and paste, which is, from where I sit, one of the downsides to the MVC side of the house is that in the component-based development world, there is this concept of packaging and distributing and reusing code. And because this code is packaged and compiled and you know from project to project to project that it's going to be exactly the same, I haven't introduced any bugs into this package across all of these projects. When you move to the MVC world and you're being told, well, you know, our reusability model is copy-paste, to me, that's, you know, not really a reusability model. And that's sort of what we're forced into when we move to the MVC side of the house, because there just isn't any way for packaging and reuse other than, I guess you can move to the assembly side of that, but that's still not quite where we're at with the component-based development.
I completely disagree, not surprisingly. So I'm working on a rather large scale MVC project right now, and we stuck with the WebForms view engine, and we are leaning a lot on ASCXs to reuse layout and view logic amongst pages, and we're doing it with a lot of success. In fact, a lot of the benefit that you get out of MVC doesn't derive from being able to reuse components so much as being able to reuse the model And while you can do that in web forms or, you know, ASP.NET, what should we call it if not web forms? Classic makes it sound like it's obsolete, which, right. You know, yeah.
Well, you know, talking about web forms, you're talking about one part of the development stack, you know, in ASP.NET. It's not all of what you use when you're developing those applications.
So there's been a lot of work around the view engines, and yeah, we don't have, you know, the Telerik MVC web controls. Well, actually, I think we do, don't we? They're coming out pretty soon. I'm sure DevExpress is working on it as well. So we're going to reach the point where we do have componentized installs. Whether how those come about, they'll probably be standard kind of web forms controls, I think, without all of the view state and stuff that gets dragged along with it in page lifecycle. But there'll be components. PHP, to take an example, doesn't have the same kind of component model and control model that ASP.NET does, and yet they still achieve some reusability, and they don't have to copy and paste every time that they work on a new project. The plugin model in WordPress would be an excellent example of that.
Well, but when you think about how they achieve that, they do that, you know, copy and paste is not just copy and paste, you know, five lines of code. Copy and paste is also move these files, which may or may not have other dependencies on other files, into a certain directory, and you're calling that the same as component-based development. In my mind, those are two totally different things.
Well, so let's define component-based development a little bit better, because, you know, I'm either moving ASPX, ASCX files into a directory, or I'm moving a DLL into the bin directory. What's the difference?
Well, the difference is that in a binary package system, the dependencies and some of the other linkages that allow that component to run are well defined, right? The metadata associated with that assembly that says, in order for this assembly to run, I need these other five assemblies. And the system is going to detect that and load and try to find those other assemblies and load them into memory. The same is not true in a file copy operation where I'm taking a script which may or may not depend upon other scripts being present in a directory, right? So there's a big difference in the PHP world for that to say, hey, this file is needed here, and all it knows is it didn't find some type that it was looking for, right? That doesn't really tell you where the problem is. That doesn't tell you there was a problem in the file that I copied, or there was a problem because some other file that it was expecting that to find some types is not present. So in my mind, there's a big difference between a binary assembly that's got all of this extra metadata with it and just a static text file, which may or may not be whole in and of itself.
One observation I was thinking about listening to that conversation is how we talked about web forms being this abstraction and people not having control over things like HTML, or people not having control over certain features that they wanted control over, HTML being a primary example and the URL space being another example. But I think it's interesting that two of the biggest complaints about web forms, one being the .aspx and the URLs, and another being the munging of the client-side IDs that ASP.NET does, which, you know, looking back now, I think it was a terrible idea, but that's kind of a killer. Microsoft has kind of said in 4.0 they're going to provide URL routing features for web forms to clean up the URL and give people control over the generation of client-side IDs, which kind of fixes that little problem. But I think web forms has traditionally really struggled with trying to give people more control over the HTML. There's been things like the CSS adapters that allow people to change the rendered output and so forth. So, I mean, there's definitely a trade-off there. It's nice to have the controls that adaptively render to down-level browsers and things like that, but I'm trying not to ramble. So getting back to my original point, so I think there's going to be some features added to web forms to give people more control, like an MVC developer would have. And at the same time, I think something's going to happen in the MVC space where component developers, control developers, control vendors, and things like that will move in to try to provide software that where people can build those richer interfaces without going to 3 or 4 weeks of effort to build something.
I think we're definitely moving in that direction. I think that anybody who thinks that MVC is the web forms killer, or that web forms is going to stay on top and not respond to some of the stuff that's gone on in MVC, I think are fooling themselves. I think that you're going to see Microsoft continue to use the two stacks to address different types of people within the development community. Some who are very comfortable with the MVC, they're coming over from Ruby or they're coming over from Java, they're very comfortable with MVC. And then you have those other developers who are just coming into .NET development. Maybe they're coming over from the Windows WinForm side or from the WPF side. You know, and for them, an event-driven model makes more sense to them. You know, and I think both sides have their advantages. Not everyone is going to be happy with both models. And I think that, you know, just like a carpenter has multiple tools in his toolbox, I think web developers need both of those tools to address different groups, different projects.
Right. To me, the biggest pain point in web forms development isn't this abstraction over control development. That idea, I think, is fairly nice. I think the big killer in web forms, where I saw people run into the most problems with, is really the abstraction of statelessness, to try to make something appear stateful, and the view state and the event handling and the code behind, and it just tended to lead people who weren't careful with those abstractions to build stuff that just wasn't maintainable in the long run.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree that there are a lot of areas that you can, you know, fall into to bad programming practices and web forms. And I think this goes back to another topic that I was talking with John about earlier, and that is that, you know, I think it's incumbent upon us as developers and incumbent upon senior developers, you know, to continue to learn and hone our craft and hone, you know, what we're doing in the development world, and to pass that along to new people who are coming into the development world. I think too often, you know, we give junior developers these tasks and we send them on their way, and there's not nearly enough mentoring, not nearly enough supervision given to them and what they're doing. You know, we talk about things like code review, we talk about some of this, but we don't really follow through in a lot of this. And then we complain because they were led down this path by drag and drop development demos, you know, in conferences and things like that. And it's like, well, as a senior developer, part of my job is to mentor those junior developers and help them avoid those pitfalls, you know, pass along some of the knowledge that I've already gained.
Well, so it's not just junior devs that are being lost, because the mentoring, I mean, we can help them, you know, learn proper development skills in either web forms or MVC, and there's, you know, strengths and weaknesses in both depending on your perspective. But the biggest problem that we have, and we kind of discussed this on Twitter a couple of days ago, at least Jeremy Miller and a few other people and I did. You know, what do we do with the senior developers who don't want to learn, particularly who don't want to learn MVC? Because regardless of whether or not you think that it's a framework that's going to replace web forms, or, you know, whichever one you think is better, I think most senior developers would agree that you should probably know both. Just because, you know, for not only for job prospects, but, you know, for general, you know, expanding your knowledge, learning different ways of programming, architecting, et cetera, et cetera. So what do we do about these, you know, these senior, you know, 5-year senior web developers who only know the drag and drop, who didn't get mentored as junior devs by anyone, who are on their own primarily and are kind of, you know, writing code that us other senior devs have to then maintain and causes us to drink large amounts of alcohol to maintain.
Yeah, I'm not sure that there's anything you can do about them, you know, any more than there's much you can do about bad apples in any industry. You know, to some degree, I come from a background where you lead by example. You know, I don't believe that you can go out and browbeat somebody into doing the correct behavior. You know, to me, that's never been very successful. While you can get people to behave in a certain manner in a short term, that goes away once the supervision disappears. You know, so for me, I don't view that as a constructive way to improve our industry. I think the better way is to go out and have successful projects where you're seeing people using MVC, where you're seeing people using, you know, solid and dry and you know, TDD and BDD and some of the new development methodologies that are out there. And as more and more success is proven with these methodologies and with some of these new technologies and frameworks, I think that those developers who choose not to adopt some of those or at least learn them to try to improve their own skills, that they very quickly will isolate themselves and it'll be harder and harder for them to continue to work in the industry. I think it's one of those problems that if we focus on the people who are doing the wrong behavior, that we're taking the focus off where it should be, which is helping those people who want to improve, which from my perspective is where we really ought to be focusing our effort.
I think that kind of goes back to a lot of things just in terms of, you know, improving the community as a whole. I think that a lot of the time where things go wrong with that, and I'm thinking kind of some of the efforts in the alt.net community, but otherwise too, it's just always focusing on the negative stuff as opposed to, like you're saying, leading by example. So it's like, okay, if you want to do something right, I really applaud the stuff like that Jeremy Miller and Chad Myers are doing with FUBU MVC. And also, like, when people had complaints about the Oxite system, you know, I applaud the people that didn't just say this is awful, and how bad is Microsoft for doing this, but actually did kind of some point-by-point criticisms, and then the team actually did a refactor and used that stuff, so everyone learned. You know, as opposed to just kind of like, I don't think that we get very far by just trying to attack what we don't like. I think we do a lot more by trying to build up and demonstrate what we would like to see.
Right. Like, you know, one of the things that I see over and over again in our, you know, in some of these online discussions, and I know Twitter is a bad place to have them. We can't really talk through a lot of the issues, but it's where people tend to congregate. But what I see coming up over and over again is people say that's wrong, but they don't offer any constructive means to move forward. It's like they don't say this is wrong and here's an example of how you could correct that. And here are the steps that would lead you to better behavior. They just say that's wrong, and that's sort of where the conversation ends, which doesn't help, you know, move anybody forward, right? It's just an attack with no constructive element to it. And to me, that's, you know, not worth really the effort of the community.
Yeah, well, I think the people that make those kind of attacks where they just say, you know, oh, this sucks, don't you know any better, and obviously you should do this, and don't really articulate reasons why, don't really understand what they're doing. They're just cargo culting in, you know, things. And they don't really understand the reasoning behind the principles. When, you know, why is don't repeat yourself important? And, you know, why does solid, you know, make sense? Or why does some parts of solid make sense in some applications or in all applications?
To some degree, I think a lot of this comes back to the Mac versus PC, the C# versus VB, the .NET versus Java, you know, the language wars and the platform wars, and everybody wants to feel like, you know, the thing that they've chosen, whether it's methodology or language or platform or whatever it is, you know, they're trying to stroke their own ego, and to me, that's sort of antithetical to what we should be doing in the community. Are in the computer science field, which is trying to advance the state of the art, right? You know, and learning from other people, incorporating where we can, and rejecting maybe a harsh word or the wrong word, but you know, leaving aside the things that we feel don't help us in our particular application or in our particular projects that we're working on. You know, a great example is MVC versus web forms. I'll come back to that. And in terms of what we're doing on the .NET Nuke front, you know, and I heard the same thing that Scott Watermask talked about a couple weeks ago in terms of community server. You have huge investments in things sometimes. And so you don't have the capability to just say, okay, hey, MVC is this great new thing and I'm going to go and adopt it for my for my platform. You know, you've got years of history built up in some of these things. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't go and learn MVC, right? And I think sometimes that distinction gets lost on people. You know, just because I can choose to continue using web forms doesn't mean I'm against MVC. Doesn't mean that I have to tie myself to web forms now and forever, right? I can say web form serves my purpose. MVC is a great framework, and I'm going to learn it, and I'm going to play with it, and I'm going to pick up the good parts from it and leave the other parts that I don't need right now. So that's sort of where I come from when I'm looking at these language wars or platform wars.
So when I think about it, is web forms versus MVC, I think I always like to put it in the historical context of where these things came from. You know, that back in 2001, 2002, when web forms came along, it was pretty revolutionary, and it was trying to do something that, was really hard, which was sort of drag the VB6 corporate developer kicking and screaming into the web world. And, to me, that's sort of the root of where the abstraction came from. You know, it was trying to provide a familiar model to people who had been used to developing in a certain way. And so, in that context, in that historical context, that made a lot of sense. I do think we've learned a lot since then. I do think, if they were building web forms now, they might have done a lot of things differently. But when you think about it in those terms, it's difficult for me to just say, web forms was never a good idea, because a lot of people would probably still be writing VB6 apps, in the clients if we didn't have web forms.
Right. There's another part of that, too, that I think sometimes is lost on people, and that's this concept that people say, well, web forms was an attempt to provide a stateful application management in a stateless environment. And I don't believe that that's wholly the case, right? Because if you go back to the mid-90s and start looking what was going on with the web servers at the time, right? They've been trying to add this statefulness to web applications for a long, long time, right? That's the whole point of the session object and the application object and all these other objects, where we were trying to store state and trying to remember what the user was doing. That's why we developed cookies and a lot of these other mechanisms. But I think that web forms was one of the first really holistic approaches where they said, we can achieve almost a complete state machine or provide this almost seamless, stateful nature in a what is truly a stateless environment. And I think that they just took the concept and ran a lot farther with it than anyone else had been able to do before. But I think we've always been trying to solve that problem, whether it was with cookies or session or application objects or all of these other things that we were doing before web forms came along.
Kevin, you had another question?
Yeah, well, just one more comment, which is that, I do totally agree that the lack of a component model, as you guys were talking about earlier, is definitely like one of the big missing pieces in MVC, and it is something that some of the other MVC frameworks provide. I do expect that to come along eventually, as K. Scott said. That aside, I do feel like, we have learned a lot in the last 8 years, 7 years since web forms, was first developed. And, I do feel like, MVC is sort of the embodiment of some of those lessons, that they've gone back and sort of rethought a lot of things that, based on those lessons. And I think a lot of the component model stuff, has sort of been picked up by jQuery and the sort of rich client-side stuff, where in order to do it, in 2002, in order to do a calendar control where you could like flip between months, having a component model like web forms like was the only way to do it. And, that's not really the case anymore. And I feel like that sort of like packaging up of rich functionality for reuse, the JavaScript frameworks are sort of carrying a lot of that banner now.
Yeah, I think I do see where the JavaScript frameworks are definitely making that a lot easier now. It's making it a lot easier to get the richer functionality that we wanted that was provided by a lot of the components in the web forms world. Grid is a classic example. When you start looking at things like the jQuery grid, and a lot of the features and functionality that was being provided by the component vendor is now being provided by this open source, JavaScript framework, I definitely think that some of the need for the components is going away, or shouldn't say it's going away, it's being transformed, right? Because when you start going over to the jQuery worlds and the prototypes and the Scriptaculouses and those guys, you know, they're all doing the same thing. They're just doing it all in JavaScript and saying, here, run this jQuery plugin and you'll have, you know, grid support, or you'll have tabs, or you'll have, you know, rotators or whatever, you know, and we're just building it now in JavaScript rather than building it in this binary object.
And I feel like the other place where we're applying lessons in MVC that we didn't apply in WebForms is sort of the testability aspects of the framework, which for me is one of the biggest things with MVC that, you know, I've done MVP in WebForms and there was a lot of pain there, and the postback model and the event model just made that just, you know, doable but not pleasant. So, you know, sort of having a framework that is designed for testability from a TDD perspective from the get-go is hugely, you know, a huge benefit in my mind. You know, sort of regardless of the MVC pattern versus the stateful page pattern.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that anything we can do to help improve the quality. You know, I come from a background where we focused on the capability maturity model. You know, and as you go through that model, you know, one of the things that's hammered home over and over and over again is, you know, catch bugs early. Catch them as early in the process as you can. Get things ironed out before you get too far along in the application development lifecycle. And it's really only been in the last, 10 years? Maybe go back 13, 14 years that we've really had these testing frameworks that have sprung up, you know, first in the Java world and then ported over to the .NET world. But, you know, we're lagging behind where they are on some of the other platforms in terms of the testing and testability. And I think that's just finally, you know, starting to crest in the ASP.NET world. And I think MVC is definitely reacting to that, you know, and I'm sure you're going to see more of that come back over into the web form side. I don't believe for a second that the web forms team is not going to address some of the testability issues. You know, I think that Microsoft, you know, Scott Guthrie is a pretty smart guy, and I don't think he's going to leave half of his developers out there without being able to address testability at some point.
At the end of your post, you talked about four reasons why you should learn MVC, kind of as a contrast to a lot of what you said were not really good reasons to learn MVC. So I think three that we've talked about already, you said one, it'll expose you to a different architecture, and that's good. You said MVC promotes unit testing, and I think we've just talked a little bit about the testing aspect. And then you said MVC will make you see how much you take for granted with web forms. And I think that's kind of just implicit when we're talking about, you know, what problem did web forms solve and why was that good? One other thing in there is you said you will be forced to become intimately familiar with HTML and HTTP. And I just wonder if you wanted to talk briefly about like what that advantage is and, you know, anything there.
Sure. One of the things that I've always promoted to developers that I've worked with and developers that have worked for me over the years is that they need to understand why things are happening in their environment. You know, it's not enough just to be able to use a component without understanding why the component is doing what it's doing, how, you know, that component works. And I think it's important that people be able to dig underneath the covers. You know, I was amazed over the last several years to see developers who had never opened up Reflector, had never sort of dug into .NET to see why something was working the way it was working or not working the way they expected it to. And I apply that same philosophy when it comes to web development. You know, I expect web developers to know HTML, to understand, you know, CSS, you know, as painful as that can be sometimes. Because until you know that, what's going on under the covers and how things should be working, you're really using a black box without being able to tell whether the black box is actually doing its job, right? How do you know if a black box is spitting out bad HTML if you don't know what good HTML is supposed to look like, right? So you can't make an informed decision at the abstracted level if you don't understand what it is that's trying to be abstracted. So I feel like that's a very important concept for developers to understand.
Yeah, along those lines, I encountered someone this week who was working with the MVC framework and was under the impression that in HTML you could only have one form tag on a page. And of course, the poor guy got that because his only web programming experience has been web forms.
Right, right. Yeah. While I will say that web forms has its place and that there's some value in it, at least I find there's some value in it, there are definitely some things in there that teach people the wrong thing. And unfortunately, people cannot always separate out what is there because web forms is demanding it versus what is there because it's part of the HTML spec, or it's part of the underlying specification. Having said that, though, just because I know how the engine in my car works doesn't mean I want to go in and have to bolt the engine in every time I want to start the car up, right? I don't want to have to put all the pieces together all every time I go to drive my car, and I don't want to have to put raw HTML together every time I want to build a web page. Sometimes I want those abstractions and to be able to use those abstractions and prepackaged components and things like that. That doesn't mean that I shouldn't and I don't understand what proper HTML looks like.
I've had the same response. I was planning to shift over to the open source stuff next, which I will. But I really agree with you on that I've over and over I've run into experiences where I will make one choice and a lot of time in favor of an abstraction, and then people will say, well, you just don't understand. Like, it's not that hard. Just go ahead and learn this new thing. And it's like, yeah, I do know that. And then I've made the choice to use this abstraction. And I still having used some MVC now in this current project and having done a lot of web forms, I think that in a lot of cases, I prefer the, I'm really into markup and CSS, and I really would prefer to have the total, to by default be working in that controlled granular mode. But if I was doing a website with a lot of forms, I think that I'd probably would prefer to use web forms and use the controls. It depends on the project and, probably get some hate mail, but that's, I think that there's some benefit to that.
Yeah. And to me, the people who say, web forms is bad, never use web forms, I lump them into the category of people who say, C# is the only language, and why would I ever learn VB, or why would I ever, use Ruby, or some of these other languages, similar to the VB guy who doesn't know C#. To me, that's kind of nuts. And I look at web forms and MVC as the flip side of that same coin.
Okay, well, I did want to talk some about the open source perspective that you have, because you've been doing open source, you were saying before the call, since 2002. And I think in the .NET world, and I think that, open source has gotten more attention from a lot of different things. Microsoft's been open sourcing frameworks. Microsoft is working with more open source frameworks. And you're just, it used to be, I remember, like, 4 years ago or so, working on a project, and we needed to do a forum, and I said, why don't we use this open source forum thing? And a senior developer I was working with was like, oh, you don't want to use that Blogger open source crap. It's probably full of viruses, and and I just could not really break through to him. He's just like, let's just buy something, and or look, I'll write it myself. I'll just crank it out. And it was really like there's a big communication gap. But I guess my point there is that I really think things have changed over the time that you've been doing open source. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I definitely, but things have definitely changed, but that's really just the perspective within the Microsoft .NET world, right? I spent a number of years before doing .NET in the Java world and seeing what was going on in the Java space, and before that doing stuff in Delphi. And what I saw in the other communities was that open source had a very big part in those communities, from the very early onset of those environments. And it was something totally new to the Microsoft world, right? When you, coming from the very early days of VB and C++ and some of those other environments, that was not where Microsoft was at. You know, Microsoft was very much promoting, you know, the proprietary code base, promoting the component-based development with closed development models, you know. But you go outside of the Microsoft community and you see things like you see Borland giving away the entire source code, not giving away, but making accessible the entire code base to their VCL library, you know, so that anyone who was developing in Delphi could actually see how the library was written. And if they saw a bug in it, they could write back to Borland and say, hey, there's a bug in XYZ line. You know, if you fix that, then it'll solve the problem for the entire development community. And, you know, while that's not purely an open source model, I think it addresses a lot of what we try to address in open source, which is, you know, give some visibility, give some transparency into what's going on. And that's somewhat of a new mindset for people in the Microsoft space. And I think we're just now coming, you know, after probably 7-8 years of this really gestating, I think in the last 2-4 years, you've really seen this start to ratchet up in the .NET space, where we're starting to really get some significant projects out there. We're starting to get significant adoption, and you're starting to see now that the .NET space and the open source in the .NET space is people are starting to look at it and say, hey, you know, there is stuff going on there. I look back at the last couple of years, and I look back at what's going on in the broader open source community. If you look back in the late 90s, early 2000s, you started seeing venture capital investors starting to invest in open source with things like VA Linux and JBoss and any number of these companies that receive venture backing. And if you looked at them, all of the ones in the open source space, it's only been in the last year or two that you've really started to see VC money flow into the .NET open source community. So I think we're starting to gain traction. I look at that as one metric that says, you know, that, hey, we're starting to be taken seriously as an open source community. And I think it's really good for us, because not only does it speak to the maturity of the open source space and how we're progressing, I think it also speaks a lot to the fact that Microsoft is not as hardline anti-open source as everyone always paints them out to be. Because if they were, you wouldn't see VCs moving into this space. If they thought that Microsoft would kill this thing off, you would never see a VC touch a .NET open source company.
Well, so there's a certain expectation when it comes to open source, whether or not that's, you know, enforced by the license or not. But the general expectation is that the project will accept contributions, or at least consider accepting contributions. As has been pointed out many, many times, you know, try to get your idea into ASP.NET MVC and try to get your patch into Linux and see which one comes true first. But, you know, kind of the promise of being able to eventually change something that you don't like about the open source project, or fix, you know, a bug that, you know, you'd have to wait 6 months for a new release from the vendor if you submitted it and waited for them to fix it. That's kind of the expectation when people say open source. And there's nothing in the licenses that say, you know, have to accept patches. They just say, you know, it's more about protecting the rights of the software creator and the rights of the software consumer. So they're saying, you know, well, I don't want to say this, but everyone knows what open source is, right? At least you can look up the definition. You can see what it's about online. Right. We'll link those in the show notes. And so when ASP.NET MVC and a lot of the other open source projects at Microsoft are released, and you say, well, I can't really submit a patch, so if I want to change something fundamental about the project, or I want to fix a bug, that the MVC guys have said they're not going to fix. My only option is to fork it. And, you know, then you've got two branches you have to maintain because you want the new stuff that the original open source vendor is releasing. And then you want to, you know, keep your changes in there. And you quickly run into this huge merge hell. And so you've been running .NET Nuke for a long, long, long time. And I've implemented .NET Nuke at a couple of places, or one place I just told them, just use this. I'm tired of you guys rewriting your own CMS every time. And so I'm wondering, you know, what's your patch contribution kind of process like? And do you think that expectation is valid? You know, is being held to this unspoken kind of standard, or in some cases spoken loudly standard?
So, yeah, I think there are a couple of sides to that and that maybe we should explore, because I think there's some aspects to that a lot of people don't think about or don't realize, and it impacts different projects at different sizes. You know, a small open source project is impacted by that differently than a large open source project. You know, when you're a small open source project and you're just getting started, you know, you're like, please help. Please somebody send me some code to fix that, you know, and that's the mantra. It's like, hey, you know, everybody, you know, if you don't like it, fix it yourself, you know, and you see that over and over and over again in those small projects. As that project gets larger and larger, and they now have, you know, instead of 100 people telling them, hey, here's a bug, or, you know, 100 people saying, here's a feature that you should implement. And that's always how it goes, right? It's here's a feature you should implement, right? It's never, here's the code for you to implement this feature. So when you're small, you know, all of the help is greatly appreciated and you want it and you're begging for it and nobody wants to give it. As you become larger and larger and more successful, you know, you have thousands of people coming out of the woodwork saying, here's my code. You know, here's my idea. Here's this feature that you should put in your platform. And what I have seen, you know, over the last 6 years is that the larger you get, the less you can accept those, you know, whole hog. Because often what you find is that person who's submitting the bug patch didn't take into account all of the other use cases that you're trying to solve for, right? They saw this one small problem that affected them and the way they used the software, and they didn't have the big picture. They didn't know where you were going with the platform or with the product. They didn't know how other people were using the product. They just knew that this one line of code change, or these, you know, 100 lines of code would solve a problem for them, and didn't really take into account that it caused great problems for the rest of the community. And I think that from a project perspective, you always have to keep that in mind, and you always have to say, you know, thank you, I appreciate the contribution. However, you know, there are all these other considerations we have to take into account. The other part of that is, you know, accepting 1 or 2 or 10 code contributions is easy. Accepting 1,000 of them becomes a management nightmare. And so as you get larger and larger, the management burden of accepting all of those, you know, goes up exponentially. The other point, the other side of that is that the risk to the project goes up exponentially as well. And what I mean by that is that as you get larger and as your project becomes more and more central and more critical for a lot of organizations who begin to use your project, the success or failure of the project becomes more and more important. In the case of .NET Nuke, you know, we have a number of Fortune 500, Fortune 1000 companies, you know, who depend upon our software and who are using it mission critical ways. And so we have an obligation to them to some degree to make sure that we are not setting them up for failure, right? We don't want to be the next SCO versus Linux battle. I don't want some guy coming back at me 2 years from now and saying, hey, you're running my code, my copyrighted code inside .NET Nuke, and that's my intellectual property, and now you need to start paying us because we want you to license that now. Even though we gave you the code 2 years ago, it's still covered by our copy, you know. So there are other issues involved with accepting contributions. It's not as simple as some guy saying, here's code, add it to the project, you know, and go forth. And I think that those are some of the challenges and some of the issues that a lot of people don't understand about what goes on in managing and running some of these open source projects.
So how do you think Apple and IBM get away with it?
From which perspective?
So they ship a lot of open source software. Maybe they're not accepting patches all the time. IBM, I believe, manages several open source projects. I'm thinking of the JVM they did.
It's kind of more, it's not necessarily like they, I mean, in a way, they co-opt open source stuff to run their business. You know what I mean? It's a little bit different. So I don't know.
Well, but even the projects that they run, when you look at some of the larger open source projects, right? The small projects are real easy. Those they can accept patches to, and it's not really a big problem. Once you start to get to a large project, very few extremely large open source projects just blindly accept contributions, you know, of any import. You know, yeah, they may take one or two line bug fix, but, you know, they're not going to wholly incorporate some new feature or functionality that they don't have some protections around the intellectual property of that contribution. The risk to them and to their customers is too great for them to just incorporate that wholesale. So they have to have protections. Just from a corporate standpoint, they have to. And I think that if you were to look around and look at how, you know, the Mozilla projects are run and look at Apache and look at what Sun has done in the Java space and, you know, anyone who's got some deep pockets behind them, you know, is going to put some protections in place to make sure that they are protected, both themselves and their customers. And that the higher up you get in terms of the customer base, the larger the customers are at the enterprise level, the more they're going to demand that type of protections. I think, you know, what you saw happen with SCO is something that the open source community is very fearful of happening throughout open source. And so more and more you're seeing those protections being put in place.
So you've been part of running a business that's depending on open source, that's shipping open source. And I think an important component of that is really understanding the licensing. And I think that's something where a lot of developers like hear stuff about open source licenses and just kind of tune out. Like, look, I don't want to get all legalistic. Just here's some code, you know, like... You know, and I think that something that helped me earlier on that I think is right is that basically when you're looking at licensing your code, you're actually talking about like how you're sharing it, like you're granting people privileges on your code. Whereas if you don't put out a license, you're holding all those. You have an implicit copyright on your code.
Right, and. That's part of the problem, right? Is that the way the laws are constructed is that you have to specifically give up your rights after you write code, for someone else to have rights to those, right? If you don't explicitly say you have permission to do this or I am relinquishing my rights in this regard, then you can always go back at that person and say, hey, you're using my software illegally. And the courts are going to, you know, 9 times out of 10 are going to side with you. And I think that's, you know, something that most people don't think about, but that I think that as you get larger and larger as a project, you have to think about. I know we've had this conversation a lot with the lawyers, and even though we had been on our project from almost day one, we have required people on the core team and people submitting significant patches to sign a copyright license agreement, which basically granted us dual ownership of that copyright so that we could do whatever we needed to do with the code and know that they wouldn't be able to come after us later on. Even then, you know, after getting it reviewed by the attorneys this past year as we were going through through our funding phase, the attorneys came back and said, you know, we need to strengthen that language a little bit because it wasn't really clear whether or not we had full control over the code was in our platform. And we had to go back to all of the developers who had contributed, and we had to go back and say, hey, you know, can we get a new agreement with you and get them to re-sign stuff? Because it is that important to some of these organizations to know without that there are no questions about where certain code came from.
Guys, anything else you want to talk about, or Joe?
No, I really enjoyed the conversation so far, and you know, appreciate you having me on the show. You know, I think there's a lot of interesting stuff going on in the web development space and .NET right now, and I think these are some really interesting topics. So
great. And do you have it? Lately we've been trying to make sure we give people a chance to plug anything. So anything you'd like to talk about? Anything that you're doing or releases of .NET Nuke or anything?
Yeah, one of the things that, you know, as I've mentioned a couple of times, .NET New Corporation, which I'm one of the co-founders of the corporation, we were funded in November of this past year. A couple of great venture capital firms, August Capital and Sierra Capital. And one of the things that we've done in February, getting ready to come up on our second release, is .NET New Professional, which is our commercial version of the open source product, starting to add some new features, some additional support options, and some of the other things that are being demanded more in the commercial space as we move into the enterprises and some of the things. So that's why some of the intellectual property discussion is so important to us, because it's something that we're going through right now at this phase in our growth. And, you know, we're really excited about some of the stuff that we're able to do with .NET Nuke Professional, and so it's been very interesting last couple of years as we've been trying to get the company side of the open source project off the ground, and we're finally, you know, making that traction, making that headway we've been trying to for the last couple of years. So it's been very exciting for us to go through that.
I guess one other, you know, at the buzzer question that I've got, because I used .NET Nuke on a couple of big projects a few years ago, and I think probably a lot of .NET developers over the course of their career have used .NET Nuke at one time and haven't maybe kept up with, you know, what's the latest and greatest. Can you talk about, like, what are some of the, you know, the most exciting things that are out in .NET Nuke lately?
Sure. Some of the stuff that we're working on right now, I think, are really going in a pretty awesome direction. You know, we're starting to add sort of network features in the latest professional edition release, where we're starting to do more in terms of tying together services that are delivered in the cloud, if you will. So we're delivering things. So you might be running your website and running .NET Nuke, you know, in a number of different locations, and we're still delivering stuff to you on the .NET Nuke application side, you know, and this applies both in the .NET Nuke Community Edition and in the .NET Nuke Professional Edition. You know, we're adding a lot of new features this year in the .NET Nuke platform. We're adding things like social networking features. Working on things like a complete UI refresh, trying to bring in more of the jQuery, more of the, you know, more of the Web 2.0, Web 3.0, if you will, feel. Trying to take advantage of some of the things that are going on. You know, I'm really excited that we were able to announce, you know, just days after Microsoft made their announcement on jQuery and what was going into Visual Studio 2010 and the MVC framework. That we were also able to announce that we were incorporating jQuery into .NET Nuke 5.0, which we shipped Christmas of this last year, and we're now extending on that and building off of that jQuery base. So those are some of the things that are coming in .NET Nuke this year, and we're really excited about them. Just the ability to start ramping up hardcore development again. We had taken a little bit of a hiatus to focus on bug development and to really focus on getting the new 5.0 platform out, which took a little over a year development to get it complete. And now we're able to start, you know, doing a lot more frequent revs on the 5.0 platform. And that's where all of our focus is at this year, and getting some things in like workflow and versioning, content versioning and things like that. So really a lot of good stuff coming this year that we're really excited about, and definitely should be seeing more and more of that rollout. I know we've got a release that we're working on getting ready to go into beta here in the next week or so. And so be rolling out new stuff behind that as well.
So that covers what's going on right now. For developers that have looked at .NET Nuke over the years, and it maybe it's been a few years, what's kind of like the broad strokes view of what .NET Nuke's done over maybe the past 2 or 3 years? Does that summarize it pretty well? Or
No, we really have made a substantive platform shift over the last year and a half, 2 years. Some of the things that we've done, a pretty big thing that we did is we tore down some of the artificialities that we had in .NET Nuke in terms of how we managed roles within the system. You know, we always had this artificial construct of an admin and a super admin, and there were certain portions of the app that were sort of cut off from being able to delegate that down. And so we've opened that model up and given people more control over who could access what portions of the application. So really just strengthened our permissions model. And we're actually taking that even farther in the professional edition, which is getting ready to come out, and really going super granular, you know, now not just on the ability of whether people can edit, but exactly what types of edit different people will be able to do. One of the things that we're really making a strong push for over the last couple of years is really abstracting out or building out our extensibility model within .NET Nuke. You know, one of the things that we had started about 18 months ago and which we really just brought to full fruition in the 5.0 platform was a unified extension installation model, so that it didn't matter what type of extension you were building, whether it was a module, whether it was a skin, whether it was a provider, or whether it was just some component, whether it was an assembly or a JavaScript file or what have you. We now have one way for packaging all of those. We have one model for what the metadata manifest file looks like that does that packaging, added rollback capability, and a lot of great functionality that we had built up over the years for modules, but where skins and some of the other extensions were sort of second-class citizens, and now we've brought them all up so that they're all first-class citizens and have a lot of new capability in that arena. So we expect to see a lot more work in the third-party development community as they start taking advantage of some of those capabilities that we've been rolling out. So there really has been a lot of work in the core platform in the extensibility model and in the permissions models and in some of those areas that really make a big difference in the day-to-day usage for a lot of administrators and developers of the platform.
Do you want to say anything about OpenForce conference?
One of the things that we started back in 2007 was .NET Nuke OpenForce, which was our annual conference that we did for the developer, designer, administrator community in .NET Nuke. Last year was another successful conference in Las Vegas, and this year, third year in a row, we're partnering up with Dev Connections to host the OpenForce conference. Again, we're going to be in Las Vegas for the North America conference. And we're going to be in the Netherlands. I'm not sure of the exact location yet in the Netherlands, but we're going to be in the Netherlands again for our European conference. A European conference is coming up in October, and the OpenForce North America conference is coming up in November. And you'll be able to find exact dates and details at the www.openforce09.com. Which is up right now with a call for speakers, but we'll be opening that up with further details as we close out the call for speakers next week and make our announcements of who the speakers are and do a full site launch.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for talking to us. That's all the time we have this week on Herding Code. We'll catch you next week.